Welcome to SDI Encounters, a podcast from Spiritual Directors International. I'm Matt Whitney. Thank you so much for listening. I offer a heartfelt welcome to new listeners and a welcome back to existing subscribers. If you like this show, please do click on the subscribe button. Here we offer a wide range of perspectives, stories, and conversations centered around community, spiritual companionship, and spiritual care. You'll find additional information, including videos, webinars, and digital publications at our website, sdiworld.org. Support for this podcast comes from Seeking Connection Across Generations, Spiritual Directors International's annual gathering of spiritual companions happening in Bellevue, Washington, March 14th through March 17th, 2019. Be spiritually replenished by a variety of spiritual leaders and participate in workshops to nourish the mind, body, and soul. Experience a community of integrity and celebrate our global contemplative calling. Learn more at our website, www.sdievents.org. Come as you are, but come ready for transformation. Rabbi Amy Eilberg is the first woman ordained as a conservative rabbi by the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. She serves as the coordinator of Jewish engagement for Faith in Action Bay Area, which is a multi-faith, multi-racial social justice organization in the San Francisco Bay Area. She teaches Jewish civil discourse to a variety of rabbis, synagogues, and Jewish organizations. Rabbi Eilberg also serves as a spiritual director, an interfaith activist, and a senior faculty for the Musar Institute. She has a book titled From Enemy to Friend, Jewish Wisdom and the Pursuit of Peace. She received her Doctor of Ministry degree from United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities in 2016. This conversation was recorded with Reverend Sefu Anil Singh Mularis over web conferencing software, so fair warning, the audio can sound a little squeaky at times.
Okay, Rabbi Amy, so if you could share a little bit about yourself for those who might not know you among our audience, maybe just give us a short bio, an intro to who you are and what you do, and we'll go from there.
So what I do, I notice that my story gets longer now as I get older. Someone says, tell me your story. It's harder and harder to do it briefly. I was ordained a conservative rabbi in 1985. So that's 33 plus years now. My little footnote in history is that I was the first woman who was ordained in our denomination in conservative Judaism. So I was ordained in the kind of in the midst of a struggle for gender justice, looking back at it. But then I went into pastoral care and counseling. So for the next 15 years or so, I was working in hospitals and hospice programs. Then Spiritual Direction found me, and I became a director now 20 some years ago. Was involved for a period of time in training Jewish spiritual directors and working to bring the news of a spiritual direction into the Jewish community, to teach Jews of the availability of this beloved practice that we have for Jewish seekers. And then during that time, I was also called very deeply into the work of peace and reconciliation, spent about 14 years deeply engaged in interfaith dialogue, in dialogue across political divides. It wasn't quite as, it wasn't a universal concern in quite the way that it is now because things have gotten so much worse. And also deep engagement in Israeli-Palestinian grassroots peace building. And then just recently, really, really occasioned by some of the horrors of the Trump administration, stepped away a little bit from the peace work to place the pursuit of justice squarely in the middle of my work. Although there's always dialogue work to be done, always peacemaking work to be done, just as there's always spiritual support work to be done. alongside and within the work of the pursuit of justice. But that's kind of my primary focus now is both my spiritual direction practice and my justice work and the ways in which the two come together.
SDI members are a contemplative lot by and large, either meditative practices or prayer, centering prayer, other forms of immersion into contemplative silence. That's great. That's wonderful. I think it's very grounding, but sometimes the transition between that contemplative part to how we socially engage can be challenging. We need to take our grounding and apply it in a focused way to tackle the ills of the world, such as they might be. Can you talk a little bit about the mix of contemplation and action based on your experience, particularly in light of the work that I think you're doing now?
Yes, it's a complicated combination of things we're supposed to be doing out in the world and things we're supposed to be exploring, I think, within ourselves. I think when you say we're a contemplative lot, I mean, there's also we spiritual directors tend to be introverts also. So just on a pure psychological level, it can then, you know, to imagining ourselves, you know, up on a dais speaking or in a place where a lot of people are shouting, seems not, you know, not very appealing. And yet I think part of the purpose of our contemplation, of our meditation and our prayer and our spiritual work on ourselves is to discern how we are called to help the problems of the world. My primary, very, very beloved meditation teacher, Sylvia Boorstein, always asks the question, toward what end? When talking about any spiritual practice, of course it's valuable in and of itself. Of course, as a Jew, I believe that the purification of my soul is part of what I was placed on earth to do. The Bible commands, "Be holy, for I the Lord your God am holy." So making myself just a little more holy or more in touch with the holiness with which I'm created is in itself a value. And I believe that if that doesn't interface with the suffering of the world, I think there's something missing in it. I think what we are called to, particularly in these times, although it's certainly not the first time there have been challenges to justice and compassion, is to marry our contemplative practice with how we're called to be active in the world. And I see that, I see that and experience that in a number of different ways. Sometimes it's about contemplative practice as self-care. Contemplative practice is my best antidote to burnout and to succumbing to hate. To hating the other, to hating the oppressor, the perpetrator of the injustice that I'm focusing on, and to keep myself healthy and well. So sometimes the contemplative practice is a tool that those of us who are natural contemplatives and those who are not all need to care for ourselves if we're to continue to be of any use in the world. Sometimes I think what's most important is for our contemplative practice to be the prism through which we see what's happening and our tool, our discernment tool for understanding what's going on outside and which of my gifts and perspectives are most likely to offer a any kind of gift to the world. So contemplative practice is what helps me discern what to do and in which places and how to do it. So contemplative practice is both to bring me wisdom about in which direction I am to turn and also how to adjust my strategies and to carry myself in that work in ways that create more good than harm. And that's really a huge challenge. There are times that I feel challenged by the big energizing gatherings, which also include what I would consider to be potentially hateful or violent kind of speech against the other who's doing things that are terribly wrong. And yet, what is it doing to us? And what are the costs to the world as well as to us for us to act out of a place of only out of a place of anger and urgency? And I'm also thinking a lot about love. These days, as we all are, as the antidote to what's happening in the world, and to what we have as our natural birthright as human beings, and somehow I'm thinking that love is kind of the midpoint between spirituality and social justice. It's where the two different kinds of energies converge. So, to the extent that my contemplative practice helps me center in a place of love, I am both then more able to do my work better in both directions, in care of individual souls and in care of the world as best I can. And also cultivating my own loving soul is itself a contribution to the community in which I live. So
we spoke a little bit about this at the beginning of this interview, but I wonder if you can tell us more about what you're going to be addressing at the conference in March, since I'm guessing it's related to what you just said.
Yeah, it is. I really just sort of said what I know about it is sort of exploring the relationship between contemplative practice and action and justice work from a number of different perspectives. There's some Venn diagrams and a sort of multi-directional process, and to encourage us to be, thank God, there are a lot of people now really thinking about this synthesis, and thinking about how important each of those sides of the polarity is to one another, how much we need all of those places and be able to center ourselves in a way that draws from the energies of both directions. So I'll be exploring that kind of multi-directionality and the different ways in which I find the nexus of contemplation and action to be fruitful for me personally and manifesting in good ways in the world, and also places in which I feel some tension, places and times in which I feel that the synthesis doesn't work for me or I can't do it. And of course, you know, I'll be doing that against the background of my, you know, life of drawing on Jewish practice and Jewish study, always exploring what does my tradition have to teach me in this moment, on both of those sides, about the struggle for justice for sure, and about who I'm to be in the world as a person created in the image of God, and how am I to do both of those things at the same time.
The title of our conference is Seeking Connection Across Generations, which is just another lens on seeking community, being in community, the whole concept of spiritual direction in the public square, and how we're all invited to be in it together. In that context, can you tell us a little more about the role of mentors in your own life? Maybe give us an example of who your own mentors were and how they were helpful to you. And then on the flip side, speak a little bit about your role as a mentor to others, and how you see the role of mentorship transmitting. Maybe it's more like a relay race, passing on the torch from one generation to the next in terms of spiritual companionship and spiritual maturity.
So first, let me say how delighted and honored I am to be able to share some thoughts, such as they are, about all of this at SDI. I've been coming to SDI for a long time, since many, many years ago. At my first SDI conference, there I was one of three Jews at the whole conference, and that that has changed. And of course, the conference has grown in numbers and in richness and in diversity in all kinds of directions. And I often hear myself saying that the content aside, the main reason that I come to SDI conferences is that for however many days we're together, it's like swimming in a sea of love, being together for those 3 or 4 days. So I keep coming back and receiving the love and hopefully intending to give out the love as well. That's very much my experience of SDI. So now that we're talking especially about, you know, so I've done a lot of peace work. So I've done, you know, been very, very interested in horizontal relationships across boundaries of identity. But now I'm 64 years old. And so I think a lot more than I used to about relationships among the generations. Of course, have had some extraordinary mentors. One is the person who really is still my rabbi, who himself is 77, who is a person very deeply versed in, deeply immersed in the tradition of Jewish mysticism. He's a student in particular of Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav. So he looks like a mystic. You know, if you met him on the street, you would see, you know, he sort of looks like a mystic with a beard and an incredibly gentle soul. So he's a student of the mystics. He's an extraordinarily gentle soul. I think in almost 30 years, I think I've never seen him, heard him say a truly harsh word about anyone. And he is a fiery justice activist. He's been arrested many times. I was just telling someone earlier today, I've never been arrested at a demonstration to my shame. And she wrote back and said, don't worry, there'll be another opportunity, which I think there will. You know, he used to chain himself to the Russian embassy when the issue that he was demonstrating was about freeing Soviet Jews from the former Soviet Union. But now it's about immigration and police brutality and racism and poverty issues. So he really is a model for me of the marriage of deep soulfulness and tender kindness on the one hand and passionate commitments to justice on the other, except that the hands feel very close together. I feel the integration in him. And actually one of my first, the rabbi who first articulated my call to the rabbinate, first rabbi who sat me down in freshman year of college and said, you have to be a rabbi, as he did to many other people, also embodied that combination. He was a kind of out there on the ramparts ahead of his colleagues and his surroundings in his clarity of vision about what was wrong with society, and also a profoundly loving human being. So it was in relationship with him that I first had a glimmer of imagining myself a rabbi. But the other thing that I think about a lot, I feel proud of some of the work that I've been privileged to do as a rabbi over these 30 plus years. So I do feel that I have things to teach based on my own experience to activists, certainly to young rabbis, to seekers. And I also find myself feeling a lot that I'm being mentored by people who are younger than I am. Certainly by our kids. My husband and I both feel that our kids, who are now young adults, and every single one of them, three children and three partners, all of them social justice activists in a whole, you know, variety of ways. And they see the world a little differently. And, you know, in a way, as a parent, what I wanted most was for my daughter to see the world exactly as I did. There was something very, you know, very visceral about that. And it took me a while to to learn to let go of that, and then a little while longer to learn that if I could open myself to the learning from her, it would profoundly enrich me and improve the quality of my life. I once heard Parker Palmer, who's now nearly 80. It was maybe, you know, a few years ago. But he was still an elder, describe an image in which the young people in his life can literally see a horizon. Like you can only just see, given the curvature of the earth, younger people can see a horizon that is past the point that he will live to see, but they can see it already. And we can't. And that's kind of a beautiful metaphor to what I have experienced in a not always completely comfortable. You know, sometimes I say something that, you know, my kids are outraged by, you know, we argue about some word that I use that they want me to know that word or that perspective is offensive, or I should be moving on. I don't want to make it sound like my kids are, you know, they're playfully argumentative. But I've learned a tremendous amount from them. So now, as a 64-year-old, as an elder, I guess, a person who is often called upon to teach and to mentor younger people, I'm also growing more humble about, I'm not sure quite how to hold how much I believe in the things that I've learned from my own experience, including from my own mistakes, from my own challenges, from the places where I got something entirely wrong, and then healed from that or moved on from that or learned lessons from that. I feel like I would love to prevent my children and others of their generation to use my experience for the good. And also to know that if I'm only teaching, if I'm only leaning into mentor, I will lose the chance. I will waste an opportunity to learn a lot of things that they learn precisely because they haven't lived for as long as I have. So that kind of multi-directionality of the intergenerational relationship is increasingly interesting and an important practice for me these days.
My last question, since we're an organization of spiritual companions, is an invitation for you to reflect on spiritual companionship itself. Well, you can use whatever frame of reference is helpful, maybe how you first became a spiritual director or a spiritual companion, how you approached that relationship with the people who came to you, and how that perspective might have evolved over time. What lessons, maybe unexpected lessons, have you learned along the way? So just an invitation to reflect on spiritual companionship and your perspectives on it.
Now, it's a beautiful question, and one I'd like to think some more about. I'm not sure that my perspective or my understanding of the work has changed. My practice of it has changed. I still believe very deeply in the things that I learned at Shalem, which is where I trained, and in, you know, the basic library of spiritual direction books that we all, you know, have read and reread and are nourished by, that as a spiritual director, I am very much a midwife. I am very much not a director. I use the language spiritual direction, but, you know, very much not a director to the extent that I am pointing at all. I am pointing in the direction of the third chair, of the third presence, of sometimes offering gentle invitations to directees to shift their direction for a moment into an arena where they're more likely to find the holy, to savor the holy, to be nourished by the holy. I've often said that basically what I do as a spiritual director is to eavesdrop on other people's conversations with the divine, whatever that means to them. Sometimes troubled conversations, sometimes what feel like one-sided conversations. But very often, most of the time, very dynamic conversations when we, you know, not necessarily people receiving verbal messages, but people moving through their lives and receiving what life is giving them, what life and God and holiness are giving them. So I think my understanding of that has not changed very much. I think my practice has changed in that in the beginning, I knew that I was supposed to be cultivating humility and trust. And it's still not effortless to do that because of all the cultural messages, Jewish and American, sense of who I am as a rabbi, you know, supposed to be a teacher and an imparter of wisdom and all of that. So I think it's easier for me now, you know, now that I don't have to worry, you know, when I was a newbie, it was almost impossible to let go of preoccupation with doing a good job, despite the absurdity of what does it mean to be to do a good job as a spiritual director. It's really, really kind of funny. I had the privilege of studying with Gerald May before he died when he taught at Shalem. And he was, I think people who knew him know that he was hilariously funny as well as profound. And he just would laugh about the absurdities of, he would say, you know, let's sit in reflection. And everybody would suddenly, you know, adjust their posture and sit like just right. And he would just laugh and like, is that how we access God? No, contorting ourselves and, you know, working so hard, you know, I don't think so. So I think I work less hard and I'm more comfortable with how I'm more and more comfortable with how blessed I am in the work. Yeah, just more deeply aware, I think, of what a blessing it is that I have a certain number of hours in my week that I get to listen in this way, which of course is an invitation to myself to stop the rushing around and all the other things that I'd be doing during the day, and check in with God myself in a very, very focused and intensive and loving way. And also to be cultivating, setting a container in a way and holding a container that's all about loving relationship in a very focused way, which is just a tremendous blessing to me as the director.
We all need teachers. We need people who show us the way. Good teachers reveal things to us and help us learn not just topics and subjects, but more about ourselves. Good teachers help us learn about our truest selves. And teachers don't just exist in a classroom. A trusted companion can be a teacher, an elder in your life who's walked their path and has insight into how you can walk yours. A younger person who has fresh eyes and new ways of knowing. I sometimes describe my 10-year-old as one of my greatest teachers. He's taught me how to be more present, more observant, and certainly he's taught me something of patience. Thomas Merton or St. Teresa of Avila are two authors and spiritual teachers who I never knew, but who have been great mentors to me through their writing on their spiritual journeys. So, who are your teachers? And can you name them? This is Matt Whitney with Spiritual Directors International. Thanks again for listening. Your time and your presence here are deeply appreciated. If you liked this show and would like us to continue making them, please do subscribe now while it's fresh on your mind. Also, we would love to hear from you, so please feel free to send in your comments and suggestions to the email address podcast@sdiworld.org. To learn more about spiritual companionship and ways that you can plug in and join our community, visit us at our website at www.sdiworld.org. Thank you. Blessings and peace on your day, and may you share blessings and peace to others.